This is Digital Story Podcast number 1040, February 24th, 2026. Today's theme is Snapseed Sprouts a New Camera, and it's beautiful. I'm Derek Story. Just when you think it's dead, Snapseed springs to life with additional editing tools, a refreshed UI, and a new camera app. And just like with some of our favorite mirrorless brands, we can capture images choosing from a variety of film simulations. And just like that, Snapseed is relevant again. More about that, plus other interesting stories, on today's TVS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. I love it when something that I used to like a whole lot comes back, even better. It's kind of fun, right? There's a hint of nostalgia when thinking about Snapseed. In the early days, it was one of the camera editing apps for our phones. It did a nice job. It really did. And then it just kind of got eclipsed by all sorts of other new things that kept coming out. But a funny thing happened. Google actually did not forget about it. They actually have been working on Snapseed, or decided to start working on it. Who knows exactly how that happened. But the bottom line is that we have a new Snapseed, and now we have a new camera with it. Now, Snapseed itself was refreshed not too long ago. I remember talking about it in a news story. But the camera is an additional part that is even newer than the refreshed UI, than the new tools. So that's fantastic. So I thought we'd start out by turning to an article that's on Petapixel, written by Jaron Schneider. And that will give us an overview, and then I'm going to talk about my experiences using this new app. All right, so we'll start with a few words from Petapixel. Snapseed's new built-in camera has film simulations, including Portra and Superia. And again, that's on Petapixel, and there's a link to this entire article in the show notes. Snapseed suddenly updated its app last year after years of silence, and it doesn't seem like the team is done. Today, it pushed an update to the iOS app that adds a camera to the interface. It's the first time Snapseed has ever had a camera. For reference, it launched in 2011 and was acquired by Google back in 2012. While it has taken 15 years to arrive, Snapseed seems to have made it worth the wait. The built-in camera features an array of film simulations, including filters designed to emulate Kodak Portra Gold and E200, as well as Fujifilm Superia and Pro 400H. There are also filters for Agfa Optima and Scala, as well as Polaroid 600 and Technicolor. In addition to these, users can access their in-app looks and custom edit stacks and capture images that apply these effects directly. Quote, "Your creative process now starts the moment you press the shutter. This update introduces the Snapseed camera, designed to give you professional control over every shot you take," Snapseed writes in its App Store update. Snapseed's camera doesn't bake these looks into the capture either. Every image captured inside of Snapseed is fully editable, and anything, including curves, film simulation strength, and all exposure settings, can be adjusted after the capture. Every photo you take includes a full editing stack. This means you can change, fine-tune, or revert any part of the look after the photo is saved to your gallery, Snapseed explains. The camera portion of the app also has a customizable layout that lets users pick among a set of different skins for the camera experience. Snapseed's camera has both simple and pro mode, with the latter providing significant manual control, from the ability to set specific ISO and shutter speeds, as well as manually focus. Fine-tune your captures with manual adjustments for exposure and focus. You can also shoot using any of your custom saved looks or film emulations to see your final version in real time. The Snapseed camera update is free and available now. So that was a nice overview by Petapixel. I want to go a bit more into it because just in case you haven't even seen the latest Snapseed editing suite or editing set of tools, I should say, I want to review those just for a moment because they're noteworthy. They really are. Just opened a picture in the app, and you know, once you download it or re-download it, if you haven't had it for a while, you know, you have to give it access to your photo gallery and give it access to the iPhone's camera. And when you open that picture, at the bottom of the interface are the tools, and you have looks, faves, and tools. I'm going to tap on tools right now. And there is a lot of stuff in here. Now, Snapseed always had a lot of stuff, you know, details, tonality, curves, white balance, you know, all that kind of stuff. Lens blur, vignette, right? But now they've also added dehaze. Dehaze is in Snapseed, which is a great tool. They've added a color tool. And then they have all sorts of other retouch and transform tools like healing. Obviously, you have crop and perspective. You even have head pose. And then under style, this is where you have the film simulations. You have glow, which is one of the tools that I like a lot. Vintage, you have black and white. Drama, you have noir. You have grunge. And then you even have a few creative things. Double exposure, frames, and text. So there is a ton of stuff in here, and these are all under the tools menu at the bottom of the interface. Now, when you go to looks, this is where you have, you know, these different kind of, well, they're looks, right? Just like we've had before with them, but now we also have film simulations as well. So if I go to the camera, I'm going to go to the camera right now, and let's say that I want to shoot in a film simulation, I just go ahead and click at the bottom there, and I'm just going to read you some of these that we have. Now you can actually shoot in these modes like we can with a Fujifilm camera, for example. So we have Kodak Portra 400, Kodak Portra 160, Kodak Gold 200, Kodak E200, Fuji Superia 200, Fuji Superia 800, Fuji Pro 400H, as you know, that's one of my favorites. Agfa Optima 200, Agfa Scala 200, Polaroid 600, and the last one is Inspired by Technicolor. So that is a pretty nice array of film simulations to choose from. I, of course, right away started by trying the Fuji Pro 400H, and it's nice. Now, the other thing that Jaron mentioned in his article, and I want to reiterate, so you have like a basic mode, and when you're in the basic mode, you choose your film simulation or the look that you want, and basically, you just take a picture. Now, if you have a camera, an iPhone with a camera control button, that camera control button works with the app, so you can go ahead and use that to take a picture, although the half press where you have additional controls doesn't work, or at least I haven't got it to work yet with this camera app. But you can hold the camera and using the camera control button to take a picture, or you can tap on the screen, of course. If you go to pro mode, and there's a little toggle switch at the top, I like this a lot. So you have ISO, and then it gives you this virtual dial here, and you can just rotate it, and you can actually set the ISO that you want. You can also do shutter speed. And so if you want a fast shutter speed for action or you want a slower shutter speed, you can control that. And then it also has manual focus, autofocus mode. And when you're in manual focus, it's pretty cool where you can just rotate this dial to get the focus exactly the way that you want. All right, pretty outstanding. And then in terms of the cameras, I have all my cameras available to me that I have in the camera app. So I have the 1X, the 2X, the 4X, and of course the 8x, and then the super wide angle 0.5. Those are all available in this app as well. So it's pretty nice. The interface is nice and clean. Like I said, it works with the camera control button. I like it so much that right now I have programmed my action button on my iPhone 17 Pro to launch the Snapseed app, and it goes right to camera. Or if I want to shoot with a regular iPhone camera, then my camera control button, I long press on that, and it launches the iPhone camera. So it's really easy for me to switch among those cameras. So I think this is pretty cool. It's a free app. It's been nice to get reacquainted with the tools in Snapseed. I forgot how good they were, and they're really excellent. It's a download that you can grab right now, and I highly recommend it. I highly recommend it. Something to play with this week, and it won't cost you a dime. Sky replacement follow-up, what our listeners say. In last week's podcast, which was titled, Is Sky Replacement Okay If It's Your Sky?, I said that I was going to pose this question to our Inner Circle members, which I did. And they really turned out with lots of good responses. So I did two things. First, I had a basic multiple choice that they could pick. And then there's a room for comments. So what I'm going to do is read you the results of the multiple choice. And then I'm going to select a few comments here to read, just to give you an idea of where our community members stand on this question. Is sky replacement okay if it's your sky or not? Here's what they had to say. So 36% said, for artistic images, I'm fine, but I use My Sky Pictures. 26% said, no problem at all, I will use whatever I can find. 21% said, I'm against it and I would never engage in such activity. And 15% said, I never really thought about it very much. All right. So 36%, they're fine using their own pictures. 26%, no problem at all, and they're fine using any picture. 21%, totally against it. And 15% basically said it's not even on their radar. So let's check out a few of the comments. Darren said, I don't have any problems with sky replacement using personal or third-party assets. Go for it. Use what you like. But I think the photographer should disclose the modification, if when selling the image. I would refer to the modified photograph as photo art. Similar to the 60s-70s photo art that was created by artists that painted highlights on monochrome photos, I have not done any sky replacement. Might give it a go one day. Lawrence said, I think it's fine if you want to do it, but I feel strongly that it needs to be labeled as such, as a photo collage or something similar. To not mention that your image is a composite of multiple images is deceptive in my book. Michael A. said, I have used it once to replace a blank sky on a drone shot of a mountain valley. My instinct is not to use it, but if I do, I would use whatever appropriate sky I could find. That's mainly because I haven't made a collection of my own. In theory, it's hard to find a logical reason to be against it. Landscape painters have always been free to interpret all aspects of an image, and we alter other aspects of photographic landscapes unrealistically all the time. White balance, contrast, dodging, and burning. So why draw the line here? Yet most of us do. A conundrum. Rob says, I don't think I've ever replaced a sky in my personal artistic work. I think of a photo as capturing a particular moment, and I work with what was there. I don't have any particular judgment about the process. It's just not something I do for my images. Commercial work is another story. For real estate, advertising, etc., anything is fair game. The final product for the client is the point, and I use all the tools at my disposal to get the desired results. Replacing the sky can mean the difference between a drab exterior shot of a house and a dramatic image that stops buyers in their tracks. And finally, from Michael B. I have numerous opinions and thoughts on this, but the one that I keep coming back to lately is this. If I have to think about replacing the sky to make a photo more interesting, perhaps that photo is not worth the effort and I should just work on making a better photo, or at least figure out what my subject really is and compose for that. All right, so like I said, really interesting follow-up. Thanks so much, Inner Circle members, for chiming in on sky replacement. I like these opinions. I think they're interesting and they're really definitely good food for thought. Let's take a look at some camera news for the week. Let's start with this article on DP Review, and I have a link to it in the show notes. Tamron's latest F2.8 zoom resurrects an idea from the 1990s. It's by Mitchell Clark here. I'm going to read you a little bit about it, and then I have a couple thoughts myself. Tamron has announced the 35-100 F2.8 DI3 VXD, a full-frame zoom lens for Sony E-mount and Nikon Z-mount cameras. As is tradition for the company, it's an unusual focal range. It's run at 35-105 f2.8 in the 90s, didn't spawn a wave of copycats. That's nonetheless intriguing. The biggest selling point for the lens is its size and weight, with Tamron promising the beauty of f2.8 in the palm of your hand. The E-mount version of the lens is 565 grams, 19.9 ounces. And 4.7 inches long, the Z-mount version being a touch longer and heavier. As a reference, Sigma's 28-105 f2.8 Art weighs in at 990 grams, 34.9 ounces, and is 6.3 inches long. Obviously, that lens goes noticeably wider and a touch further. But if you don't find yourself wanting to go wider than 35 millimeter that often, it may well be worth the weight savings. The lens has a customizable button and can accept 67mm filters, the same size used by Tamron's G2 Trinity zooms. It has a fluorine coating on the front element to protect from oils and water, and it is moisture resistant. Tamron says it will be available on March 26 and will retail for $899 for the E-mount version and $929 for the Z-mount version. It's a relatively aggressive price for this kind of lens, so we're looking forward to getting our hands on it to see what we can do. So here's what I'm thinking about, and by the way, I'm looking at the lens, I'm looking at a picture of the lens on the DP Review article, and it is nice and compact, especially for an f2.8 constant aperture lens. It looks good on the camera, you know, it's not too short, not too long kind of thing. But I don't know about you guys, but when I think about a lens like this, I'm thinking about putting a lens on and leaving it on, using that zoom range for what I anticipate will be most of my needs for that day or for that session. And I have found that 35 millimeters, although I like shooting at that focal length, there's a lot of times that I want wider, much wider. And I even run into this with my Nikon, my 28-400mm zoom, which I put on my ZF a lot when I'm out in nature, just kind of wandering around, just want to have one lens on. And the 400mm reach is terrific, and I love that. But I have found even at 28mm, I sometimes want a little wider. For the kind of shot that I'm envisioning. And I have found for me anyway that 24 millimeters at the wide end of the zoom is more important than 80 millimeters or 100 millimeters on the long end. So I'm thinking that, yeah, this lens does feel like a bit of a throwback design. We're so used to being able to shoot wide. I mean, back in the day, 35 millimeters was my wide angle lens forever, right? And I remember when I got a 28, I was going, holy Toledo, this is fantastic. But a 35 to 100 f2.8, I'll be curious to see how this lens does. I just don't think it's wide enough for the way that this lens will most likely be used. The depth of field advantage no one mentions about Micro Four Thirds. This is an article on fstoppers.com by Alex Cook. I want to read you a little bit about it because I thought this was interesting. You know, we usually think about the depth of field as a problem with Micro Four Thirds. All right, here we go. You keep hearing that 50 millimeter f1.8 on a full frame gives a look that smaller sensors can't match. That might be true, but it misses the point when your goal is depth, not blur. Coming to you from Chris Bateson, this thoughtful video, and he's referring to a video that they include in the article, centers on the OM system OM1 and a simple idea. F5.6 on Micro Four Thirds often gives exactly the look you need for long exposure coastal work. Bateson heads to Mapleton Beach with a rock wall and textured clouds, sets the lens to f5.6, dials in 60 seconds at ISO 200, and builds the exposure with a polarizer and a 6-stop ND filter. He watches the histogram instead of chasing extremes. The frame is vertical, heavy on negative space with attention to balance rather than blur. You see how moderate aperture holds details from foreground rocks through the sky without fighting diffraction or starving the sensor of light. He addresses the common refrain about 50mm f1.8 lenses by mounting a 50mm f1.2 and shooting it wide open. On Micro Four Thirds, that field of view behaves like a 100mm lens on a full frame because of the 2x crop factor. Wide open, the depth of field shrinks fast. Focus becomes fragile. Rocks that should anchor the frame drift soft. The scene loses structure. When he stops back down to f5.6, the detail returns and the image settles. The comparison is blunt and visual. You see what shallow depth of field does to a layered coastal scene and why it may not serve the subject. There is also a practical angle. With Micro Four Thirds, you start with more inherent depth of field at any given aperture compared to full frame. That allows you to shoot at f5.6 and still hold front-to-back focus while keeping shutter speeds flexible for long exposures. Bateson leans on Live ND and later experiments with live composite mode, stretching a base 3.2-second exposure into roughly 5 minutes. Clouds streak, water flattens, and the camera builds the frame in real time. He mentions one trade-off with live composite: clouds can look slightly sharp or jagged instead of fully smeared, which may or may not suit the mood. So I think there's more in this article. And like I said, the link's in the show notes, plus the video is in the show notes too. So you can watch that video by clicking over to F-Stoppers for the article. You know, we talk about, you know, the challenge with Micro Four Thirds often being we can't get that softer depth of field that we sometimes want. But then again, Micro Four Thirds is fantastic at macro photography because it does have that little extra depth of field. And I have found it very nice in portrait photography, not worrying about, you know, focusing on one eye and then having the other eye be out of focus because of the shallow depth of field that could happen with a full frame, especially when you have like an 85mm or 100mm lens on that camera. So it's really, I think, comes down to just understanding the tools that you have, especially if you shoot both full frame and Micro Four Thirds, which many of us do. Many of us have both formats. And when you do, then choose the right tool for the job. But I love this discussion about, hey, this inherent depth of field also can be very useful. Last thing in news that I want to mention is this adorable little flash. Oh my gosh. This is an article from amateurphotographer.com, and I have a link in the show notes. Zenico ZA12 dual dial flash review. Clever auto metering for any camera. Now, this little retro designed flash is very small. It has both a manual mode and auto mode, but the auto mode is unique, and that's what we're going to cover here, and that's why I decided to share parts of this article with you. The Zeneco ZA-12 is a small flash unit that's designed to work on most cameras with a hot shoe, both film and digital. It offers a choice of either auto metering using a built-in light sensor or manual control. There's nothing remarkable about that, but where it stands out compared to similar units lies in the way that you can adjust how it works in auto mode to accommodate a much wider range of camera settings. Key to the ZA-12's abilities are the dual dials on top. By setting the right-hand dial to one of the positions marked in red, you can manually set the light output from full power down to 1/64th in whole stop sets. However, when you move away from manual operation, that's when the real cleverness begins. Most flash units with built-in auto metering force you to use specific exposure settings. With the popular Godox Lux Junior, for example, that's F28 at ISO 100 or equivalent. With the Zeneco ZA-12, you can specify your preferred settings using the two dials, with apertures from F2 to F11, and sensitivities from ISO 50 to 1600. Set these two dials to match your camera settings, and the unit will adapt its light output accordingly. That's very clever and very useful. So I'm looking at the picture here of this top. And so one of the dials on the left-hand side, has settings for F2, 2, 8, 4, 5, 6, 8, and 11. So those are the F-stops that you can use. So let's say that you set it to F4, and then you want your ISO, or you're using ISO, let's say 400. Well, the other dial on the right-hand side has ISO settings from 1600 down through 50. And so then you go, okay, so you set the ISO to 400, the F-stop to F4, and then that's how it gauges how much flash output it's going to do. Which is this like so logical? I mean, that's the way I've always wanted auto flashes to work, something like this. This is a cute little guy for $50. I'll just read you a few more features. The internal battery is rated for 400 flashes and recharges via USB-C in about 70 minutes. The hot shoe is a basic single pin connection that allows the unit to be used on any camera that has a hot shoe with a central contact. Zeneco offers the ZA-12 in two colors to match your camera, either black with silver dials or two-tone silver and black. And the kit contains a push-on diffuser, a soft pouch, charging cable. They're all supplied in the box. $50 for this cute little guy. And they show it on some Micro Four Thirds camera. They show it on an Olympus here. And it just looks so cool. It really does. So anyway, here's their verdict. They give it 4 stars. They recommend it. The Zeneco ZA-12 is a clever little flash that generally works well, and its small size means you can carry it around easily. It could be a particularly good choice if you use multiple cameras, both digital and film, and don't want to buy a dedicated flash unit for each. I'm going to sleep on this, but right now, I want to buy one. All right, stick here with a little Virtual Camera Club news. I want to thank our Inner Circle members. I want to acknowledge them. First of all, they provided some really great information for us in this week's podcast, don't you think? Wasn't that fascinating, their thoughts on sky replacement? I just love finding out what people think. I really do. And especially in our world here, in our photography world, it's illuminating, it's interesting, and it's very educational. So that's part of the Inner Circle experience. It's not just getting discounts for workshops, which is very nice, but it's also being part of a community, being asked what you think, and being able to read what other people think. And we have people post questions, hey, I just bought this. I'm looking at these accessories for it. What do you think? You know, all that kind of stuff. If you're interested in becoming a part of this community, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. You can sign up there, and next thing you know, you'll be hearing from me and welcoming you to this wonderful community. And a big thanks to our Inner Circle members for supporting this podcast. And finally, I'd like to give a shout out to our friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. These are the folks that help us realize the art potential for our photographs. You know, when you look at pictures on your computer, it's fantastic, right? It's convenient. You have your whole library of images there, and they look pretty, right? They look pretty backlit. They're very nice. And then if that's all you've ever looked at, right? And then if you take one of those great shots of yours and you print it and you put it on some beautiful paper and you get the exposure right for the printing, you know, you get it looking just the way that you want. And then you hold that up and suddenly you feel like your world has changed. Your photography world has changed. You have gone from an LCD-toting photographer to a paper printed image that is very artistic. And all you really need is the inkjet printer that you probably already have, a little bit of knowledge, which you can get on the Red River Paper site, and some excellent paper, which you definitely can get on the Red River Paper site. If you want to give this a go, all you have to do is click on the tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story, nose around a bit, make sure you use our discount code for free shipping, and create some artwork for yourself. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.